Very well, very warm welcome to this BIPS webinar. It's been a little bit of a lull since our last one, rather a busy month in January, but we're very happy to be starting again. And if you look on our website, you'll see we have two or three more events lined up in the coming months in March and April. And it's at the moment, they're a very great pleasure to introduce Laura Weinstein, who is the Ananda Varakkurarama Swami Curator of South Asian and Islamic Art, and who has been in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston since 2019. I first came together with Laura in 2006, I think, when I was working at the in Princeton. And she joined the Shahnameh project as a research assistant and helped enormously in going through some of the Shahnameh manuscripts in the New York Public Library and one or two other places, which of course it takes a certain amount of persistence and initiative to get through. I mentioned that she's at the moment the curator for South Asian and Islamic art. But there's a great development she told me about very recently, that they've managed to raise money for a new curator in Islamic art. So this will help share the burden of dealing with this splendid collection at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. So very many congratulations to you there, Laura. And obviously this will increase your opportunities for focusing on what you're particularly interested in. Laura's written several nice papers. She's more a specialist, I would say, on Indian painting than Iranian. But of course, it's all very much part of a similar tradition. So without more ado, I invite her to tell us about this exciting installation, which has only been seen in public for a short time because it was set up just before the onset of the pandemic. And so we're very much looking forward to seeing what's there and how you've arranged their display. Laura, thanks. Over to you. Oh, I should just say before you start that you can send questions via Facebook, apparently, where it's being shown live. And also, if you'd put them in the Q&A chat, well, not the chat, the Q&A box, as it were, at the end, and I will try to field these. And if we can't cover them all, apologies in advance. So thank you, Laura, over to you.
Thank you very much for that nice introduction, Charles. Thank you to Sylvia and the British Institute for Persian Studies for inviting me to give this talk. It's a pleasure. And thank you for all of you who have come this evening. I am, as Charles said, this installation wasn't open to the public for very long before it closed for COVID. It is open again now, but to limited numbers. So it's really nice for me to have a chance to share a little bit of it with you. I'm going to share my screen. We'll get going. All right. So this evening I'm going to be giving you kind of a brief visit to one part of the new gallery that we opened in 2019. We called it the Arts of Islamic Cultures Gallery. I'm going to take you into just one section, but first I want to give you a little bit of an overall view of the space that we're working with. This is, let me get it to load. This is the old gallery. So this is the same space that we have now, but this is the way it was installed in around 1982, and it had been the same until 2019. The gallery is just basically a very elegant and simple space, or was at that point. You can see it's a long gallery. In museum jargon, we call it a long gallery, and in regular street talk, we call it a hallway. And you can see on the left side, there were cases set into the walls, and on the right side, a series of very large windows covered with wooden geometric screens. Those screens were locally made. I don't know exactly who made them, but I think they were made in the New England area out of wood. And they're very beautiful, but as you can see, they're very large. And you could say in some ways they sort of dominate the space. In the cases, We showed a range of objects, glass and metalwork, but certainly a lot of ceramics. And I'm afraid I do remember once sitting in the space when a docent came through, and I remember listening to her saying, "This is the Islamic gallery and here are the dishes." So that has been very much in my mind as we developed the new space. And here I'm just showing you an overall view during the planning process, but which gives you a sense of what the new space is like. So the new gallery divides that hallway up into 8 small rooms. Most of the windows are now gone, except for one that has that kind of rainbow colored rectangle you see, which is another topic which I could talk about. Each space, each of these rooms, I'll see if I can show you with the pointer, you know, so here's one and then the next, 7 this way and 1 here. Each of these rooms has a theme and no more than 10 objects. The modular design of this new gallery was chosen because it makes it possible to alter one space significantly without triggering a redo of the entire gallery, which is prohibitively expensive. So I see the gallery as a space for experimentation in the display of a collection that frankly has received not enough attention in the last century, despite having a tremendous collection of very important objects. As Charles said, I'm thrilled that at the end of last year, we got the funds to create an endowed curatorship for Islamic art. And I think that that will mean that the gallery that you're seeing here in the future will become kind of a platform upon which the new curator can experiment and explore the collection and find ways to bring it to life for the public. So now back to the dishes. The Museum of Fine Arts has an excellent collection of Persian ceramics. You're seeing a range of different objects here just to give you a taste of the variety. And I'll show you one or two examples. This is a really gorgeous late 17th, early 18th century so-called Gombrun ware dish. And it's remarkable in particularly because it's 45 centimeters across. And so it's just really a uniquely impressive piece. We also have, in addition to the Persian ceramics, a range of really important Ottoman examples of blue and white in particular, as well as the more polychrome, but I wanna focus on blue and white here. So here we have an example from about 1525 from the Ottoman Empire. And then what is more, in the last 10 or so years, we've had the opportunity to borrow objects that can supplement these. And so here you see 2 extraordinary Yuan Dynasty blue and white pieces. On the left, we have a ewer that has a faceted octagonal shape, possibly inspired by metalwork from Iran, Syria, or Egypt. And you can see that at some point in its history, the spout and the handle must have been broken because gold fittings were added to replace them. And we think those were made in the Ottoman Empire. On the right, we have a large cobalt dish with a dragon of white slip. And this is one of only 3 similar dishes in the world. There are 2 others like it, and they belong to the Ottoman and Safavid royal ceramics collections. So this is the kind of group of objects that, one group of objects that when redoing the gallery, I was thinking about what to, how to group them, how to bring them alive. And for me, I found myself attracted to the idea of the chinikhane as a way to do a couple of different things with the interpretation and the display of this collection. So one of those is that the chinikhane, which I'll get into in a minute, might be a way to evoke the trade, the appreciation, and the emulation of Chinese blue and white ceramics, actually Chinese ceramics full stop, within medieval and early modern Islamic courtly societies. A second goal is to give the ceramics a setting that frankly brings drama and provokes awe, and therefore maybe helps visitors understand how seriously these kinds of objects have been taken in the past. And finally, the third idea is that it might open up opportunities to engage visitors with the idea of Islamic architecture and its relation to objects. And I just want to show you that the space that I'm going to talk about, the chinikhane display, is right around the corner, literally kind of steps away from this architectural fragment. that's installed in the galleries. And so it is a place to talk about architecture and bring architecture into conversation with objects. I do also have some misgivings about the idea of taking inspiration from the Chinihane tradition. And I wanna share those with you. It'll give you a little bit of a sense of the process and the complexity of something like this. But first I wanna go a little bit into the history of the Chinihane for those of you who might be less familiar with it. And then I'll get back to anxieties and questions at the end. The term Chinihane has, I think, a deceptively simple meaning. Of course, in Persian, China house. But I think it's deceptively simple because that literal meaning is, of course, not the only meaning that the phrase has had. The roots of the Chinihane can be traced back to the Timurid period, to the ruler Uluk Beg, who had an estate in Samarkand in the 1430s, where there seems to have been a pavilion faced with Chinese ceramic tiles, tiles imported from China. And I've seen scholars say that it's possible that there could also have been ceramic vessels imported and displayed in that space, but I don't think we know for sure that that was true. And there's another, there's records of another Timurid Chinihane as well, which may actually have been a room with niches for ceramics, built in the 15th century for Mir Ali Shir Navai. And then from these Timurid prototypes, which unfortunately I can't show you here, I'm now showing you the Safavid examples. And so I'm seeing, we see these Timurid prototypes as then kind of giving rise to a number of other forms. The most well-known, of course, is the Chinihane created for Shah Abbas in 1607-08 at the shrine of Sheikh Safi in Ardabil. This Chinihane held the royal collection of ceramics. It stored them, but it was also a place to display them. And at the same time, it's been described by scholars like Kishwar Rizvi as a private imperial sanctuary, a symbol of a princely aesthetic, and also a public symbol of the Safavid's identification with Sheikh Safi. So a place pregnant with meaning. Now, as Mehreen Chida Razvi has recently explored in an article, and I'm borrowing a photograph from her in the center on the bottom. The Chinihane took a different form in Mughal India. In their empire, sometimes it took the form of rooms with niches that could be used for the display of precious objects like ceramics. For example, in the Jahangiri Mahal of the 1560s, and that is what you see in that lower central image there. But in subsequent centuries, the idea evolved into a popular form of architectural surface decoration. So you get these kind of blind niches with sometimes empty, sometimes with the image of a vessel, as you have in the center on the top here. You can see this depiction of vessels situated in the niches. And to go a little bit further, I think, than most art historians have done, and I am not claiming to be an expert on the Chinihane or the architectural forms, but I do think there is evidence for the use of these very ornamental niches in Ottoman architecture as well. Of course, they don't share that same Timurid heritage that the Safavids and the Mughals possessed. But you see this use of these very beautiful arched niches as a form of architectural revetment and also just as a decorative technique. So, where I'm going with this is that I think all of these empires, first of all, they all engaged in unique, different ways with this notion of a form of architecture that was designed for the display of precious objects. And that seems to have developed hand in hand with the widespread taste for Chinese porcelain. And at the same time, so that's the first thing, is sort of engaging with this form of architecture and the taste for porcelain. And at the same time, they all collected Chinese ceramics very actively. They sponsored the production of ceramics that were taking inspiration from or innovating upon ideas from the Chinese ceramic tradition. and so they share that, these early modern empires certainly share that as well. So with all this in mind, we undertook the process of trying to design a Chinihane. I wanted to just say, I'm not ready for this slide yet. I'm gonna talk about it later. So here you see the very beginning of trying to design our own display. And I'm going to go slowly through these slides so you can see the evolution. And as I do show those slides, I just want to talk about kind of the decision and the goals. And so, for example, the idea was that we would use this space to combine the mostly Persian, but also some of the Ottoman ceramics, and then also Chinese ceramics that were quite clearly made for the Islamic world. So kind of those three types of objects. One day, I hope that we also have a Mughal blue and white that we can include, but we don't have that in the collection yet. We would use this space, not just to present our objects and link them to unique forms of Islamic architecture. So not only, I mean, to do some of the things I've talked about so far, but then also beyond that, to bring up the notion of collecting within Islamic societies, within Persianate societies. For example, we could alert visitors to the fact that when objects like the ones on view were stored, displayed, and used in Ottoman, Safavid, and Mughal palaces, many of them were already antiques and were appreciated for the way they represented a tradition of the past. So this would be a way of cueing visitors to think past problematic assumptions about potters or craftsmen or applied arts and get instead to notions of connoisseurship and collecting as part of these artistic worlds. My hope was that the dishes would eventually come to be seen as having serious and symbolic and artistic significance. What we ended up with is a display that has a painted plum-colored surface with a matte texture. It has, as you can see, 8 openings. A text panel appears on the left that has an explanation of some of what I, you know, an incredibly reduced version of what I just said to you, along with images of Ottoman, Safavid, and Mughal chinikhane architecture. On the right, you can see, I'll go back a little bit. So it's on the right in this image, you have object labels for each object that tell a little bit more about the way that they are made, about the kinds of Chinese examples, ceramic vessels that these objects respond to, and just tries to unwrap, unspool a little bit of the complex story of the give and take between Chinese and particularly Persian, but also that region's ceramic traditions. And then finally, the last component you can see on the right and in the bottom center there is I had a local potter make some porcelain, in fact, porcelain ceramic tiles glazed and using patterns from the objects that are on view in that space. And that gives people a chance to touch, to experience the feeling of a glazed ceramic tile. So now let me finish by sharing some of my more complicated, difficult feelings about this installation. As you saw, our old gallery had those very large, prominent wooden geometric screens. A colleague of mine used to call them, used to say that they brought the gallery the tiki room effect. What she meant was that they were a simulation. They were intended to other as much as they were intended to contextualize. And there was the issue also of how much they dominated the space. I really wanted to get away from all of this. That was a concern, and it made me view the whole concept of this chinikhane project as something entailing a certain amount of risk. One way that I tried to mitigate that risk was by linking the shapes to actual architectural structures. And this is what I wanted to show you. I'll go back really quickly here. I feel concerned. I feel like there can be a problem when you have displays in a gallery space that are like these arches here. They're designed not to mirror actual Islamic architecture, but rather they're designed to come out of or mirror ideas, sometimes potentially Western Orientalist ideas about Islamic architecture. So for example, when you design an arch like this based on an idea in someone's head, or you know, those window screens based on an idea of some wonderful New England artist, and then you use that to create a display that you put into your gallery, I see that as being 2 or 3 or even 10 degrees removed from the reality of the architectural tradition or the artistic tradition that you are looking to bring people into contact with. Another focus of mine and kind of a worry of mine in bed at night was the degree of finish, the way we treated the kind of fine details of this installation. One day I remember very clearly the designer that I worked with coming into my office and saying that there was an artist she knew that we could work with who was very good at painting faux marble. And she wanted to know if I wanted to have this whole installation be faced with these faux marble panels. And given that the Mughal buildings, many of the Mughal buildings that have these chinikhane motifs or niches are in fact made of white marble, I think that would in some ways be appropriate, but it really set off the kind of tiki room alarm for me. And so instead, we talked about it a lot, we ended up with a surface that is very clearly made of the same materials and with this in the same palette as the rest of the gallery. In other words, it is very obviously, I hope, a display case and not an architectural fragment like that Mughal arch, the sandstone arch I showed you a little while ago. Also the arches, the apertures in the gallery, in the installation are very simple shapes. They're not mirrored very closely on the profiles of the actual arches that you see in some of the historic buildings with chinikhone structures. One final issue that comes up for me is that with the display that I've introduced you to today, you do lose a lot of what is unique in the architectural and the ceramic cultures of the Mughal, Safavid, and Ottoman empires. Because of course their buildings don't always look like this, you know, there's so many varieties, and the making and the meaning of the ceramic objects differed very greatly. So I think in the future that an online or some kind of a virtual resource could help to unpack that a little bit. But for now, I think there's no doubt that this display does some flattening out of the differences of the diversity and variety within these traditions. So when COVID struck, we were about to do a survey, a visitor survey, to see how was the gallery being perceived by visitors, how is it striking them, and what are they taking away. And that obviously got paused, and I think that we will see it up and running again in 2021. But as a result, I can honestly say I'm not sure yet how the chinikhane section of this gallery is working. I look forward to learning more about it, to speaking with audiences in the galleries, and with people like you today. And as I said, I also see change in the future, when perhaps after a couple of years, maybe we'll try something entirely new in this space, and maybe we'll take it down and come up with a new idea. In the meantime, I will admit that I think it's very beautiful, and it weaves together a whole host of stories that I truly love to spool out with visitors to the MFA and online with you today. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you very much, Laura. That was very nice, and particularly, of course, well, partly to see the objects themselves, but also to get a sense of the thought and the problems that go into making a new display, especially one that's been sort of stuck in stone, as it were, for so long. I wonder what the tour guide would have thought about the appropriate dishwasher for them. Anyway, I had a couple of questions, but I think we better start with this, an intervention by Robert Gardelin. Do you know him? Robert Gardelin. Anyway, he said, I've been answering his questions in the background, but it's got to the point where I don't know the answer. Is the blue charger with the reserved white dragon from the Ardabil, well, he said, which is in the Ardabil collection and now in Tehran. But I mean, then we got a little bit further down the conversation. He thinks there are three of these, one in Tehran, one from the Ardabil collection, and then one sold in 2014 by L&H, who are I've forgotten. He's written it down somewhere. Anyway, an auction in 2014. He thought if yours was a fourth one, this would be a major discovery.
No, indeed. This is, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to speak about the details of the sale, but this is one of those three.
All right, okay.
On loan to us from a very generous local collection.
Good. Oh, it's on loan. Okay.
Yes, yes. That and the octagonal ewer, those two objects, are great loans that kind of complement the collection we have.
Okay, now we've got Nasiba Beymatova, who is taking issue with you about your translation of Chini Khane. Your interpretation, Chini Khane, is a Chinese house, is not exact. Chini refers to something that comes from China. So the correct form would be a room displaying Chinese porcelain. That may be
Thank
correct.
Thank you for that comment. I think there are people with extremely deep knowledge of the term, how it's been used, and the architectural form. And I'm reliant on people like that, but I'm not fully their equal, and I admit that.
She says, as it's clear from her name, she comes probably from Central Asia. She says, even today in Central Asia, Chini refers to Chinese porcelain. But I think that's more obvious. I mean, it's really, a display place would seem to be a reasonable interpretation. Beatrice Campi asks, is the installation permanent or will it only be at the MFA for a limited time? Thank you for a brilliant talk.
Thank you. So the installation is a permanent gallery insofar as anything any longer is permanent. So that gallery will be for Arts of Islamic Cultures for years, if not decades to come. I hope to see it expanded and moved one day, but for now that's where it is. But as I said, the gallery is intended to be modular and intended to be experimental. So I think this installation and the rooms around it will be the same for the next few years. And then I hope to be able to turn it over and do something new.
Margaret Squires had the question I was going to ask, actually, about the, mine was about the choice of things to put in those niches, but she said, do you intend to rotate the different ceramics or is it designed specifically to fit those installed? I assume you would want to change them around a bit, but you must have plenty more you could put there.
There are 3 to 5 other objects that I think would fit in well. That are currently in the storage. In fact, when I showed you that slide that had, 6 or so objects, a couple of those are not out right now. They are being used in other spaces or they're in storage. So we will be able to rotate. You could see that behind the apertures there, it's just kind of each one is an empty box. So I think we do have the ability to rotate and switch things out. One of the things you might have noticed is that the object in the upper right is not a kind of cobalt blue and white ceramic, but more of that kind of turquoise that becomes very popular at a certain period. And that one, that was a decision to include that I don't know, I'm not sure if I'm totally happy with it. I might want to swap that out. But what you couldn't see in the image is that has those, there's a very common two fish design. Where you have two fish kind of swimming around in a circle in the center of a dish. And I think that has very long tradition precedence in Chinese ceramics. And in this piece from Iran, from 13th century or so, there are 3 fish. And, one could get into a whole conversation about whether that's an improvement or a misunderstanding or innovation. It completely depends, I think, on how you want to characterize it. But you can clearly see some of this dialogue between West and East Asia, which is obviously a big theme that I'd like to bring out. So lots of objects to think about.
Yeah, well, it's exciting to have such a wonderful collection to play with. Amanda Hanush Steinberg says it was such an interesting journey into the thought process for creating such an installation. Thank you. And then the question is, with the new position for an Islamic art curator, do you think the Islamic and South Asian gallery spaces will separate?
will separate?
Yes.
I hope you all have a couple hours, because I'm going to try to be concise. This is the relationship between the South Asian and the Islamic galleries is a big deal for me. They are currently separate. There is a gallery for South and Southeast Asian art. And unfortunately, due to very technical reasons, we don't currently have much Islamic material in the South Asian gallery. The Islamic material from South Asia, unfortunately, is kind of exiled to an edge of the Islamic gallery. And so my goal is actually to really erode that boundary as much as possible, to bring more Islamic material, South Asian Islamic material, into the South Asian gallery, and kind of vice versa, just trying to actually work against the division that has been really overdrawn in scholarship, in politics, and in the galleries.
Yes, lots of interesting dilemmas, really. Anyway, William Robinson, hello, William, says, you showed the Chini Khane in the Ottoman, Safavid, and Mughal worlds built to display Chinese porcelain. The Chinese themselves collected antiques. Can you comment on how they would have displayed ceramics in this period? I mean, you made the nice point that these aren't just dishes, and they are, you know, it is a connoisseurship of a collector's item, and they're precious things. But it's a good point. How did the Chinese recognize their own antiques, as it were?
Yeah, thank you for that good question, William. I don't know the answer, but I think it will be very interesting to find out about that, absolutely. And my assumption, sort of my automatic thought that it must be very different is, you know, perhaps that's not true at all. In fact, I wonder if there's some form of kind of architecture with niches that occurs all over the world in different ways. So I'll have to get back to you on that one.
You need to look at a few installations in Chinese, I suppose modern museums would probably be rather similar. I've never been to China. I've been to Japan a couple of times, and these things seem to be just so elegantly out, just on a shelf or in a sort of niche in the wall, you know, a single thing. But whether the Chinese have the same aesthetic for that, I don't know. Quite a few of these questions. That's a good thing. Valentina Bucaleri, thank you for your lecture. Apart from Arda Beale, what were the main sources that helped you structure the installation?
I do think that I'm not sure if I entirely understand your question. There's a lot of great architectural, great literature about the Arda Beale Chini Khane, and also about the Ali Kapu, the pavilion in Isfahan, which has the gorgeous Chini Khane on the top floor. I think those two are certainly
That's the best.
Yes, the music room.
Sorry to interrupt. I think that's normally billed as a music room rather than a ceramic display up there.
Right.
It's the same idea.
There seems to be some amount of debate about how that space was used, for sure. But yes, it's called the music room. And some of the niches are clearly not intended, you know, to be functional, to hold anything. The Mughal architecture, there are so many examples of, Chini Khane motifs become really ubiquitous in Mughal architecture, and even beyond into Deccani as well. So there's a lot of great literature on those buildings. I haven't found a lot of sources yet, but I'd love to read, if someone can send in or point me to places where this topic comes up in architectural history of the Ottoman Empire, I would love to know.
It's certainly very common now. I mean, in just ordinary private houses, say in Bukhara, you know, traditional homes, you have all these niches in the walls, exactly like Isfahan or Arda Beale, for that matter. It's obviously a sort of tradition for displaying precious things in the house that has had a very long lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Pamela Karimi says, I'm looking forward to bringing my students to see it and write about it. So she's congratulating on your talk. Could you please, and then Gulzar Yousafi, could you please share a bit more about the niche design process and the symbolic significance of the architectural components you were hoping to engage with?
The design process started with me bringing books to the office of the designer and kind of swamping her with things to look at. And then there was definitely a back and forth phase where she was, I think, originally trying to mimic the forms very closely and then kind of backed away from that. We also, you could probably imagine that the construction, the building department of the museum had never made an Iwan before. And the half dome, the roof of the space was something that they had to puzzle out together and figure out how many facets to give it and how to support it. So that was also a really intriguing experience and one that made me think you could probably do interesting installations, projects with contemporary architects or artists who are really deeply engaged with Islamic architecture and who would maybe we'll have one day some different kind of Iwan and Mukarnas and different forms that come into the gallery. For now, this was really basically a process of kind of looking at precedents and prototypes, imitating them and then backing away and then kind of back and forth. Ultimately, I think some of the apertures in the space hint a little bit at Chinese architecture. There's the one that's kind of round with a stripe of space above and below. And that was the architect's, the designer's idea. And I think that her goal was a little bit to kind of pull up the Chinese aesthetics and bring that into the space a little bit more. But for me, it really came down to a lot of this dilemma about how real should it be? How can we make it not uncomfortable for people where it looks like it's trying too hard to be the real thing? So that was maybe sort of an overriding concern.
There are hundreds of questions, Laura, more than any other talk I ever remember hosting. Ashley Dimmidge says, thank you, wonderful to hear you thinking about behind the display. When I saw it in person, I was indeed struck with the intended awe, but I will be very interested to hear how the general audience perceive and understand it whenever you are able to conduct your survey. So that doesn't require an answer, but it's a nice comment. Ron Fuchs says, how did you go about selecting the plum color on the wall?
I will tell you all the truth. the designers are just wonderful. They're all artists. And they had been looking for a palette for the whole gallery, which would be, a set of 8 colors or something. And then each room, because they're each intended to have a distinct theme, would have a different combination of those 8. So maybe one room would have 3 of the 8 and another room would have, one of those, but 2 others. And so each room has a kind of related but distinct palette. And where they got those colors from, I think was a photograph of a Japanese hotel, which is to say they get their inspiration, not always, from deep research, but from the design world. And then they come, then we go down and we pull the objects out of storage and put it up in front of a big sheet of plum color or, brown or green or whatever it is and kind of test it out. So I'm very grateful to that Japanese hotel because I do think that the colors are very sympathetic to the materials. But there's no deep symbolism there. And I just want to say, because maybe someday one of you will help me find the answer to this, that I think that explaining the story of that actual back and forth and the intricate relationship between Islamic ceramics and Chinese ceramics, the trade relationships, the traveling of the motifs, all of that, it's an incredibly challenging story to tell audiences. And so I do look forward to seeing how the gallery works for people, but I can already tell you, I'm not sure if you noticed, but the text on the right-hand side where the objects labels are, it's way too many words. Nobody can process all of that. And it's because there's so much to say, and it's just, I think it's something really hard to put into a 30-second experience. I know there's a 2-day workshop coming up about blue and white Chinese ceramics and Islamic ceramics, which I hope, you know, maybe all of us will attend and we'll learn more about how to talk about this material. But I think that is gonna have to change in order to make this display truly successful, because it's just too complicated and too many words.
Yeah. We have a nice comment from Valerie Gonzalez. It's not really a question. It's just, thank you for this nice presentation. I think it's a very successful display, bravo. I see the construct as a creative evocation of the original Chini Khanes, fitting the location and greatly enhancing the masterpieces. It's not an imitation, not a cliched park theme of device. This is instead a new form with aesthetic connotations. We know Valerie's very keen on aesthetics. This is a challenge indeed not to fall into the cliche that you addressed really well with this powerful installation.
Thank you.
Nice comment, yeah. Isabel Miller, I think she may have missed something she said. Can you say anything about the relationship between the Chini Khane and the music from in the Ali Kapu, or have I missed something? Apologies. And especially the notion of the apertures in the Ali Kapu being for acoustics, or is the relationship purely fortuitous?
I mean, I would, if you'll allow me, I will just really recommend. I would really recommend this article by Mehreen Chida Razvi on the Chini Khane. It's 2019, so it's a recent look. And Kishwar Rizvi's chapter in the catalog of the Shah Abbas exhibition. I think both of those get into that in some detail and talk about the uncertainties, because there are, I think, quite a lot of questions about both of those buildings.
Mm. Emily Shovelton, hello Emily, says thank you for your excellent talk, but she has a good point, which actually I was going to ask. Can you tell us a bit about the other sections of the gallery? What are the objects and themes?
Thank you, Emily, for that question. So the themes, like the Chini Khane, try to thread the needle, showing the diversity of Islamic art, the impossibility of creating a single narrative to explain it and present it, and yet also trying to show that it has internal coherence. So you could look at all of the sections as sort of falling on one or the other side of that kind of knife edge. There are sections that look at one particular place in time that are more toward the diversity end. For example, there is a section that looks at Islamic South Asia around that sandstone arch. There is a section that explores Arts of the Book, where we have a beautiful little place to sit down and with your magnifier directly copied from the Metropolitan, because it's not broke, so we won't fix it. And, you know, so there are some of those spaces. There is a space where we bring together Christian, Jewish, and Islamic objects from Islamic lands in order to explore the idea of light and God. Which we have paired with the contemporary sculpture wall piece by Munir Farman Farmayan, which is also very much imbued with light. I'll just say, since people seem interested, that the very opening of the gallery displays an object that was produced for the 1876 Philadelphia Centennial Exhibition, which was the first World's Fair in the United States. And the object looks like a door. When it came to the museum, it was supposedly a mosque door. Over the years, it's been called a minbar door, but it's really an assemblage of 13th, 14th, 15th century Mamluk woodwork that doesn't belong together. So we begin the gallery with a space that is trying to self-reflexively look at the history, particularly of the MFA in kind of participating in the idea, the construction of the idea of Islamic art. We pair that with actual Mamluk objects. And in fact, those Mamluk objects, two pieces of metalwork, which we have that are very beautiful, but they also have been altered. They're pieces that were, you know, the inscriptions were changed when the owner changed in the medieval era. So I try to talk about the movement of objects being something that happened throughout the Islamic world and continues to happen and is also part of the museum's history. In other words, this idea that as objects change owners and move across borders, they get invested with all kinds of new narratives. And so sort of trying to talk about the museum's own role in that bigger picture.
Rosalind Haddon has a comment, really, in a way it follows on from what you already replied to an earlier question. Are there any plans to use the same format to highlight different media such as glass and metalwork? And this refers back to the whole collection, obviously.
Do you think she means the same format like the Chinikhane?
Well, maybe, yes. Well, niches, perhaps.
I think that's something to think about. I mean, especially considering that the Mughal examples certainly were used to display candles, I mean, for lighting, or maybe glass vases, glass objects. So it's something to think about for sure. Thank you.
Sarah, so put my glasses on. Molina, thank you very much for your talk. Could you say a little more about the type of audience research you'll be conducting? Do you have specific questions you're hoping to ask?
Well, I've already kind of exposed you that for the Chinikhane part, I want to know if people are completely confused about the relationship between Chinese and Islamic ceramics or not. I mean, because I've tried to, we didn't focus on that today, but I have tried to help people understand how, for example, Persian potters were interested in the whiteness of ceramic vessels. And so tried to achieve that in certain ways. I mean, so that story about where the inspiration was coming from and how people were innovating and emulating, I'm interested in if that's coming across at all. But also if any of these other major points that I was trying to make are coming across. So I have so many questions about that section and whether it's being read the way that the 50 or so of us are talking about it. I can tell you that I was really lucky that the research department at the MFA was able to work with me to do what we call a formative study. So before the gallery opened, we took these themes, we kind of made cards, big kind of rectangles with images and a little bit of text about these different themes. And we brought them to visitors and interviewed them and got their responses to some of the themes and to other questions about, you know, the term Islamic art and about what they expected to see, all of that. And so we used that to inform the gallery, and then this study will be kind of the summative study. I'll give you an example. The Divine Light section that I told you about was one of the ones that we brought in out to people in the formative study phase. And it was consistently chosen. It was the most frequently chosen theme more than any other theme, it was either chosen as most interesting or least interesting. So in other words, it was a completely polarizing theme. And some people just absolutely hated it and didn't want to see Christian or Jewish art in that space, didn't understand. And then other people were absolutely enamored of it. And so we did learn interesting things and then try to make small adjustments, or big adjustments in order to kind of improve the gallery.
I imagine one question would be, because it's common to any interesting, you know, you have the so-called general public and then you have more specialized interests. One question would be, do you want more or less information? Because the labels could be much shorter, but a lot of museums and so on, they have a sort of fact card, by the door where you can read more if you want to. Is that something you'd consider doing, or is it just a nuisance and people run off with them, or they start getting dog-eared and you know, then you have to think which languages you're going to use, etc., etc.? But you're right. But, I mean, sometimes you look around the place, you think, oh God, I don't want to read all this, but you do want to know what it says, you know.
Yeah, it's a dilemma. I think I really do hope one day to have an online place where people can learn more. We do have the problem with having the cards is that you do have to restock them and manage them, and it can be difficult. We already are doing that in one end of the gallery that I haven't mentioned to you, which is a space where we have a prompt, a question that we ask visitors, and then they can write on a comment card and leave it for us. And so we're very busy working with that. And I'll tell you, the question basically is, how do people understand the relationship between culture and religion? I'm trying to provoke people to think a little bit about what Islamic culture, which is a phrase in the title of the gallery, what do we mean by that? And learn what people think about culture and religion generally. And that's been also very interesting and a lot to think about and work through in terms of how to interpret in the future. Turns out there are 1,000 ways that people can describe the relationship between culture and religion. It's infinite.
Yeah. Back to Ron Fuchs, who asked the question about plum. I think he says the colors look great. And then he asks if you could say who is sponsoring the upcoming symposium on blue and white.
Is it Houston? Can somebody write into the Q&A and help? Is it the MFA Houston? It's been, somebody will know.
Yeah, certainly. There's a very star-studied audience you have, Laura. Someone will certainly know. Yeah. Moya Carey says, thanks for your talk, Laura. Who arranged the 1876 woodwork collage? She's obviously been paying a lot of attention to it. Do you know who organized that?
Who arranged it? It's a story that I've researched and I haven't completely finished, but you probably know the name Ambroise Baudry, the French architect in Egypt who did a lot of work in the 19th century to make kind of Mamluk style furniture and furnishings for people's homes and designed homes. And he, I think, was probably the head of the workshop where that was made. But maybe someday we can talk about that object, because I would love to get some people to help me do some more research in Europe to really pull together the story behind it.
We have another question. Denise Marie Tisse asks the same thing about where's the upcoming symposium. Farouza Melville says, thanks, Laura, brilliant insight about your new display. Congratulations. Just to comment on your idea of Chini Khane, I wonder if you have seen the latest trend of the contemporary imitations in Central Asian public spaces, hotels and restaurants. Well, you know, as I said in my little remark, I mean, they're all over people. The old houses in the Bukhara places, you have all these forms, but I guess, the modern hotels and restaurants are obviously copying the same to make people feel at home, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Do you want to answer anything more specifically?
I don't know as much as I'd like to about that, but perhaps I can find images online since travel isn't possible these days. I'll look around. Thank you.
Teresa Zishkin, this was fascinating. I wish I could visit the collection now. I'm wondering to which degree manuscript illustrations help understand how ceramics were displayed within these niches and how the shapes of the niches correspond to the shapes of the vessels themselves, which is an interesting question. And certainly when you go to Ardabil, you think, well, these are all the niches, but were they all individually cut out for a specific piece, or did they, you know, some of them don't look as though it'd be terribly easy get a piece in there.
Right. And sometimes they're part of the masonry. Dr. Chita Rasby brings this up. Sometimes they're part of the masonry, and sometimes they're part of a facing So there are really different ways to approach it. But thank you for that good idea. I think I am gonna use that idea in the future, because right next to the space that we've been talking about is the space for the display of manuscripts and manuscript pages. And one can absolutely find pages even within the MFA's collection that show these niches, because they're just so so common. Although I think much more common in Mughal, more common in kind of Indian painting than in Persian painting. So I'll have to pull together a rotation and then try that out.
Two confirmations about the blue and white. Amanda says, yes, Houston. And Gulzar Yusufi says, MFA Houston, between sea and sky, blue and white ceramics from Persia and beyond. I think I saw this advertisement actually through May the 31st, 2021. So that's American, through May. I mean, I suppose it means, I don't know what that means, but it's either starting or finishing on the 31st of May.
Well, I don't know that, but I know that there is, I think very soon actually is the first of the symposia. So,
right, so maybe it's a weekly thing for a month or something like that. Anyway, MFA Houston, that should give you the advertisement. Okay. I need to keep an eye on the time. I think we've got a couple of minutes. I wonder if we've had a fantastic set of questions and comments. Oh, well, someone's, Amanda has produced the link. Moya Carey says, yes, he built Gaston de Saint-Maurice's Cairo house. Margaret Squire says, Houston. Yes, okay. Well, I think one more. Emily Valentina Brucoleri has recently worked on the display of blue and white in Persian painting.
Mm. Can you say that name one more time?
Valentina Brucoleri. She gave a question earlier on, actually. I don't remember which one. And then we have someone from Taipei writing. I better get this in very quickly. Your fantastic Chini Hane display was the last exhibition I saw in March before the pandemic. Just a quick note, the contemporary Ping Imperial Court in China used to catalogue its ceramic collection and custom made a wooden box for each piece for storage. In terms of display, photographs or paintings from the Qing court of that time show ceramics either on the floor or on wooden shelves. That's in answer to William Robinson's question, really. Then Isabel Miller, this is definitively the last thing. There are niches in the depiction of the library in the Mosul manuscript of the Makama of Hariri. For storing books, yes. I was going to say you get pictures of books being stored. Yeah. Huh. Anyway, well, that was 36 questions and answers, not including a couple I typed the answer to, Laura. So if nothing else, you've had a spectacular success in terms of the interest that you've aroused in this question, quite rightly. I mean, it's so interesting to see how museums are playing such a large part, really, in our appreciation of art and understanding the issues. It's not simply a case of going along and gazing at old things. You know, there's such an educational role and so many questions to consider when you're putting it across. And I'm sure your Lilly Endowment grant will be very pleased with your the way you're approaching this and joining up all the dots. So I think it just really remains for me to thank you on behalf of all our viewers for this. And it's a very lovely talk. And just to remind people, it has been recorded and it will appear live. Well, it will be a slightly edited, in other words, a bit of chit chat cut out on BIPS's YouTube channel in a day or two. So a chance to listen to it again. So thanks very much, Laura. It must be lunchtime there now, so I think you deserve a very healthy sandwich. Great. Well, thanks very much, and hope to see you again before too long. Good luck with the exhibition when it reopens.
Thank you very much.